This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of New Books Network. My name is Morteza Hajizadeh, your host from Critical Theory Channel. Today, I'm honored to be speaking with Dr. Ben Heimer about a wonderful book he published with Manchester University Press in 2023. The book is called Lifestyle Revolution, How Taste Changed Class in Late 20th Century Britain. Dr. Ben Heimer is Professor of Cultural Studies at the University of Sussex in England. Ben, welcome to New Books Network.
Hi, Monteza. Great to be here.
Thank you very much for accepting our invitation. Before we start this interview, can you please briefly introduce yourself and tell us about your field of expertise, which is cultural studies?
Right. So, yeah, I'm a professor in cultural studies at University of Sussex, and that means that I teach across lots of kind of humanities areas. So I'm interested in things like art and film, but also food and furniture. But I guess my big specialism really is post-World War II Britain and its culture and society.
Lifestyle Revolution, How Taste Changed Class in Late 20th Century Britain. I'm not from England myself, and I grew up in Iran. That's my home country. But when I was reading your book, there were a lot of points that I could identify with, which happened in my country, sort of in early 21st century, about how a whole range of new, how consumerism, let's say, changed people's taste, and even the idea of class. I will make references to them as we're talking about the book. But to begin with, can you please tell us about how you define taste in the context of your research?
Yes, I think you're right. I think that what happens in England is very particular to England, Wales and Scotland and Northern Ireland as well. But similar things are happening across lots of places in the world, which is a kind of modernization of people's kind of domestic lives. And that's kind of like a significant thing. And really, I think one way of understanding this is that it's about taste, and that taste is itself kind of changing. And so for me, taste is not necessarily about kind of having good taste or having bad taste. For instance, how you might think about kind of taste within, say, the field of art or literature. But it's really about how people's kind of everyday life is being altered by kind of new ideas, new choices. So taste is about kind of how kind of period tastes change, but it's also about the role of taste in society, how that is being altered. I mean, one of the things that I was kind of interested in was simply that there's more taste. You know, taste is during the late 1950s, 60s and 70s, there's just more things to have in your home to choose to think about in terms of taste.
And what I liked about your book, and especially this chapter when you talk about taste, is that you discuss David Hume's ideas about sentiment and judgment. It would be great if you could talk about how he can help us better understand taste and how have his ideas shaped the way taste works in post-war Britain.
Yeah. David Hume was important to me. He'd been important to me in other books. I mean, he's an 18th century Scottish philosopher. So in some ways, it's kind of hard sell to say, hey, yeah, this guy is going to be really important for thinking about taste at the end of the 20th century into the 21st century. But in my area, and in sociology and lots of other areas, the idea of taste has really been dominated in the last 50 years by a French sociologist called Pierre Bourdieu, who really sees taste as this kind of cultural capital that allows some people to thrive and other people to be diminished. It's very much a competitive world of taste. Now, what Hume did that I needed was that he took it away from thinking of it purely in those kind of competitive terms. And he brought in this idea of sentiment, about taste having a kind of sentimental relationship to us. Now, one way of translating sentiment for a kind of modern world is to say it's about feelings. And this seemed crucial to me. It seemed absolutely fundamental to how we think about things. We don't, no one simply likes a piece of music because they think they're going to go get ahead of someone else in some sort of competition around taste, or buys a sofa just because they think that they can show off better. I mean, it might be part of it. It might be a kind of element of it, but there's no one out there saying, yes, this is all my pictures on the wall, all my music and books are really there just to kind of show off. So Hume gives us this understanding of taste really from the inside, about how something is felt. And this seemed crucial. So this idea of sentiment was absolutely kind of central there. So what was important was that music or furniture or food might make you feel something, might make you feel comforted, but also might make you feel modern, cosmopolitan, really kind of in the mix of things. And we kind of know that. We know that when we buy some clothes that we feel are really, sum up a certain kind of sense we want to have of the world. And we feel that this is important. Now, the other side of Hume's idea of taste is to do with expertise. You know, he is basically saying that because taste is so subjective, we need experts, or maybe we don't need them, but we certainly get expertise telling us what is better than something else. Now, for Hume, these experts aren't kind of objective people. They're people who are full of sentiment themselves. They're full of feeling, but they just, you know, their job has been to kind of know more about these things than other people, to have, you know, sampled more food, read more books, been to more plays, sat in more chairs. And of course, now we live in a world that's very much dominated by taste advice. So we can see how important Hume might be for kind of understanding taste generally, that on the one hand, there's this kind of very deeply felt subjective experience of taste. And on the other hand, we live in a world of people constantly advising us. They might be in the newspapers, they would be online, but also their advertisers, their magazines, promoting certain objects, certain styles over other styles.
What about, let's talk about the role of consumerism and consumption in creating the sense of being modern. Because it seems that, and I'm sometimes even trapped by this deception, like I feel that if I consume some particular commodities, I'm acting modern, or I'm more modern. Can you talk about this, how this consumerism creates a sense of being modern?
Yes, I think consumerism is kind of hugely important. I mean, consumerism is old as the commodity itself, but clearly consumerism really, really speeds up, really kind of ramps up in the late 50s into the 60s in a country like Britain. And I mean, one of the things that consumerism does is just produce more choices. And it does this partly through making things cheaper. So kind of technology is really, really important for producing new goods. You know, washing machines, irons, TVs become cheaper in the 60s and 70s. At the same time, wages in relationship to the cost of living get higher and higher. So there's more money going about. But the big thing is that consumerism kind of allows more and more people to enter into this world of choice. So you were talking about how some things make you feel modern, and clearly not having them will also make you feel not modern. So today, if you're a child growing up and you don't have a mobile phone, you won't feel kind of modern. You won't feel, you know, one of your kind of peer group. And then there'll be kind of details like, well, have you got the latest iPhone? How these things work. So consumerism is both bringing more and more people into the fold where taste would be important. And they're also giving you more and more things to choose. Now, sometimes, you know, within, say, clothes and fashion, there are kind of big shifts that happen. I mean, one of the examples in my book is how hats for men change. So if you look at kind of old newsreel footage or just films from the 40s and 50s, you'll see kind of crowds of people in London and kind of men mainly kind of going to work, and they'll all be wearing hats. But they won't be choosing those hats. They won't be saying, well, I'm a businessman, I might wear a beret or I might wear this hat. It's kind of part of their suit, part of their identity, part of their job to wear one particular hat or another. Now, for us, later on, hats are absolutely not like that. They're not about simply being part of a kind of uniform. Hats are now part of a kind of identity, of personality, and that's how we can kind of see commodities, how we can see consumerism. And one place where that really happens is in the home. Not for everyone and not all at once, but more and more people become invited to think about their home as a place that could be modernized, that could have the stamp of their taste, of their personality on it. So rather than simply taking the furniture from parents and grandparents and having a traditional household of these items and not really having to think much about what they mean, they're just what you have in a house. In the 60s and 70s, we're beginning to be kind of all of us to some degree kind of invited to think about decorating our homes in particular ways, of thinking about what kinds of curtains, what kind of flooring, what kind of seating we're going to have.
So in your book, you talk about several shops. I think they were franchise shops and also magazines. So let's talk about one of them, Terence Conran's Habitat Shops. How did it promote a particular kind of lifestyle, which you call habitat living? And what did Terence Conran mean by the expression "you solid citizen"?
Okay, I mean, Terence Conran, he's a very interesting person. He kind of emerges out of the art school milieu of the 50s. He's at the Central School of Arts and Drafts. And he kind of emerges at a moment of the Festival of Britain, of really the birth of the welfare state and the birth of a kind of social democratic Britain, which was going to be more democratic, which was going to be less class conscious. And this is partly, I think, what he means by this idea of producing solid citizen furniture. It's this idea that this is kind of democratic. It's available to lots of people, or certainly lots more people than had been previously available for kind of new furniture and new furnishings. At the same time, he's a designer himself, so he's a designer with a kind of interest in what we would kind of roughly call kind of modernism, kind of Scandinavian looking furniture. So he's got a big furniture business that's doing quite well by the early 60s. And he gets together with a number of people to set up this first shop of Habitat in 1964 in London's Chelsea. And it's not really a place that's going to just sell his designed furniture. That's not its job. It does sell some things that Terence Conran designs. But really, now we think about it much more as curating a set of tastes that all go together. This was one of the kind of themes of the shop. It would take that idea of, like, if you're a kind of modern, groovy person and you wanted the most kind of trendy, most up-to-date household, you wouldn't have to go to loads and loads of different shops, to travel kind of Northern Europe to find things, or go to the Mediterranean to get particular cooking implements. You could get them all from Terence Conran's Habitat. So it was this kind of idea of kind of curated living that was kind of important to it. And it was also about speed. So one of the themes of the shop was that here you could get kind of instant good taste. Everything kind of went with everything else. But it wasn't a taste that was simply singular. It wasn't like the idea of the Bauhaus, where everything would have a very, very kind of similar look to it. For him, it was about kind of eclecticism, about feeling that something quite kind of traditional, like a Chesterfield sofa, could go with a Italian plastic chair and table. And that could also go with some wickerwork baskets and things like this. And what brought it all together was this idea that Conran talked about, which was this idea of controlled casualness. So there was control there, but it was casual, and it was meant to be a kind of new, more kind of laid back way of living. And this has to be thought about in terms of the kind of longer history of kind of changes in how houses and homes were being thought of. Really, what you're seeing is the rise of much, much more informality. Informality across the kind of social spectrum. A lot less kind of deference to parents, to different generations. A lot less deference across the classes. So houses might be kind of places that kind of traditionally in the 30s and 40s, you'd have a room that was very much kind of kept the best, where you'd be very polite, very kind of careful. But now with Conran, you're thinking, actually, those rooms are much more for living, for this kind of informal kind of lifestyle, where we'll be, everyone will be much kind of closer together in terms of their hierarchy, and kind of just enjoying and having kind of more sensual enjoyment.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
You also talk about magazine supplements in the 1960s in promoting this consumer culture. And you specifically talk about magazines such as Nova or Spare Rib. And you describe how they reflect changing attitudes towards issues such as sexuality, race, femininity. So it would be great if you could talk about this and specifically give us some examples how they, for example, reflected this changing attitude towards these social issues.
Right. And I think I need to go back a bit to the kind of the emergence of these newspaper color supplements, really, in the beginning of the 60s. So magazine culture had been very much a kind of part of thinking about taste, about thinking about interiors. You know, there had always been, since the 1920s, kind of magazines like Good Housekeeping, other magazines like Homes and Gardens and this kind of thing in Britain, very much skewed to a female readership. These were kind of magazines for women to think about their kind of professional world of being housekeepers and looking after the home. You know, they'd have kind of instructions about how to, you know, what to do in your day. I remember reading a 1920s Good Housekeeping annual, I think it was. It was a kind of collection from the magazine, and there were these, you know, on Monday, this is how your day went as a housewife, and these are the kind of jobs you did all the way through the week. Now, in the beginning of the 60s, first the Times newspaper, the Sunday Times particularly, the weekend version of that newspaper, brought out what it called this color supplement, the Sunday Times color supplement. It was partly an idea of giving a kind of free gift. You know, this was something that's usually quite expensive, a color magazine, and here we are giving it away free with a newspaper with you know, a big important newspaper. And quickly other newspapers followed suit. The Weekend Guardian, which was the Observer, the Telegraph, the Express, all these very, very kind of establishment newspapers had these color supplements. And what they did was they brought those concerns that had normally been addressed to women, food, clothing, holidays, interior design, and they brought them to a male audience, you know, the people that the men who would be kind of reading about kind of international news or about sport would also be picking up a kind of magazine that was about cooking, fashion, and interiors. And so this is kind of like a really big shift in terms of how families, couples, how people were being addressed and how men were being brought into this kind of idea of taste in a kind of domestic setting. So these are kind of big shifts that are really kind of happening across society. And although a lot of these newspapers are very much aimed at a kind of middle and upper middle class, they have much bigger kind of circulations. These magazines are kind of circulating everywhere. There wasn't in the 60s and 70s, you couldn't go into a dentist or a doctor's waiting room without picking up kind of piles of these kind of magazines. And they became something, I think, that we also, or the people used to kind of measure themselves against. So they might be introduced to, I don't know, kind of continental foods there. And they might not be able to kind of replicate it themselves, but they might be able to kind of think about food differently and try out new ingredients. And similarly with some of the kind of design elements, some of the kind of domestic stuff that was going on. So these are bigger, these are part of kind of bigger social shifts that are happening at the time. And of course, in the 60s and 70s, we're getting what we call second wave feminism, an idea that actually it's not enough having the vote. There's inequalities all around. And one of the kind of big kind of inequalities is to do with personal experience. And this is where that kind of feminist call that the personal is political becomes kind of really, really important. So it's not simply just that the world of work is unfair, or that the world of politics used to be unfair, but because they excluded women from voting, it's now that the world of kind of domestic life is kind of unfair. And, you know, later sociologists would talk about how this was really that kind of women were being contradictorily placed, that more and more jobs were being open to women, more and more women were working in offices, for instance. You know, that was a kind of relatively new thing in the 50s and 60s. But also factory work, you know, the new kind of plastics industries or electronics, a lot more women were kind of working in these roles. But after work, they were still expected to come home, make the food, look after the kids, do what sociologists call the second shift, you know, the next shift at home. And kind of magazines also kind of reflect this. Magazines are kind of taking these things on, and kind of new magazines are emerging. I mean, I use these two, well, there's kind of three magazines I'm kind of particularly interested in. One was very much later on, Root magazine, which was about kind of black culture. But kind of earlier magazines were, one was this magazine called Nova, and the other was Spare Rib. I mean, in some ways, they're chalk and cheese. Nova was very much a kind of high-end, high-fashion magazine, very kind of glossy magazine, but actually not kind of snobber. It wasn't a kind of snob magazine in the way that a lot of the kind of high-end fashion magazines might seem to be. So it's about being a modern woman, as a kind of, very much kind of part of this. And it had a social agenda, and that social agenda was not a world away from the social agenda of a magazine like Spare Rib, which was very much concerned with being an actual kind of feminist magazine that would be encouraging women to become activists, to get involved in kind of women's rights, into consciousness raising groups. But they were both interested in things like prison reform, about everyday racism in Britain, but also about kind of changing social phenomena. For instance, like the rise of divorce, which you know, has seemed to be on the rise since the 60s onwards. So they're doing a number of things. They're identifying particular audiences, a kind of new women audience of women who are consciously aware of a kind of structural unfairness, but also introducing them to both different ideas of fashion, but also different ideas of kind of social campaigning.
There was another trend in post-war Britain, which was the rise of home ownership and also this desire for gentrification. And in the book, you talk about how this trend created this desire again for working class areas or homes. So people became more interested in working class neighborhoods or homes. And the decoration or gentrification of those areas? How did it impact the idea of class realignment? And it would be good if you could talk about this term, class realignment or class mobility.
Well, I mean, class is one of the kind of the big issues of the book. And I think I end up having quite a kind of complicated relationship to class. I mean, I think so one way of thinking about class, the way I think about it is, you know, there's obviously a structural relationship in terms of class. You know, either you own things or you don't own, you know, in kind of classic Marxism, the proletariat were people who owned nothing but their labor, their ability to labor. And the bourgeoisie owned the means of production. You know, this was a kind of 19th century idea. So what happens then if class is no longer simply about that, or becomes much more kind of complicated? What happens if you do mainly own your labor power? You work in a factory, you operate machines, you kind of produce things, you're a kind of manufacturer, and someone else owns that factory, someone else extracts kind of profit from it. You know, that's again kind of classic ideas of kind of Marxist understanding of class. What happens when more and more people are actually in a really kind of contradictory position where they both own stuff or seem to own stuff, like a house, like property, but also they're working in factories, or they don't actually have much control of their working lives. You know, they have bosses. Now, the big revolution, as I see it, is to do with home ownership, and it's a kind of massive revolution within Britain and other countries too. But my examples are all to do with mainly England. Actually, it's slightly different than Scotland. At the end of the First World War, in 1918, roughly 10% of the households in England and Wales were owner-occupied. Lots of middle-class people wouldn't own their own homes. You know, why would you? Why you might be want to move in a couple of years' time. Why get into that kind of enormous debt to kind of participate in that? So if you've got middle-class people, working-class people, and they're all renting, that's a different context than if most of those people own their own homes. So between 1918 and by the end of the 70s, that figure of 10% moves to about 66%. You know, that is an enormous increase. So you've got kind of 2/3 of households being owner-occupied by the end of the 70s. So what you've got is a kind of massive investment of people into their homes, into the you know, where they live. You know, they're invested, they're in debt around it, they're property owners. But they might also be union, belong to a very strong union, factory workers, all sorts of things. So one of the things that's happening in the 60s and 70s are more and more people being invited to become kind of homeowners. And one of the ways that happens is through things like new towns, through things like kind of suburban developments, and people can be encouraged to move to the suburbs. Now, partly this is also to do with housing in inner city areas like the East End of London being thought of as not really up to scratch. They need to be cleared because the housing is really old. There aren't any kind of bathrooms in there. There's no indoor plumbing. So rather than kind of modernize them, let's kind of build new houses elsewhere. So there is that kind of encouragement to you know, own your own home aimed across the classes, really. And that kind of works slightly different depending on who you are and where you're working and kind of what your interests are. So at the same time as you're getting these kind of enclaves of kind of new suburban builds of kind of new areas, you're also getting older inner city areas being gentrified, turned into very, very upmarket areas with kind of boutique shops and all sorts of things like that. So these things are kind of happening together, and they're in a kind of complex relationship. I mean, I grew up in very near a small town in Essex, and one of the things it was famous for was for having kind of big developments, big housing developments that were known as kind of overspills. And what they were overspills of the slum clearances happening in London. So people being moved out of London in the 50s and 60s because their housing was being demolished, and given, you know, offered kind of new housing with new factory jobs out in areas like in kind of what was once kind of rural areas of Essex. So these were, you know, this was also happening, but within areas in London, for instance, in areas like Notting Hill or Islington, you're getting another movement, which is people thinking, okay, well actually, the inner city offers us all sorts of things. Well, one of the things it offers is Georgian townhouses, Victorian townhouses, and I know people have thought these are pretty rubbish and kind of old-fashioned, but actually we can do something with these. We can turn them into kind of lovely new houses. And this, to go back to Habitat, is one of the things that Terence Conran was famous for. He was very much famous for what we would now call flipping. You know, he'd buy a kind of ruined old Georgian sort of slummy house and turn it into very kind of aspirational, very kind of expensive house, and the area would also kind of change its identity gradually from being somewhere where migrants lived, where lots of these houses were rented with multiple occupancies. So there'll be, you know, different families on each floor of a four-story Georgian house. And gradually these areas would kind of change. I mean, you can see it in somewhere kind of famously the film Notting Hill, which was set in an area that was one of the worst overcrowded slum areas in the whole of Europe. And slowly through the 60s and 70s into the 80s, it's become one of the most expensive, the most kind of desirable places you could possibly live if you could afford it. I looked it up the other day, and you know, a three-bedroomed flat in North Kensington, which is the area of Notting Hill, would be roughly about £3 million. I'm not sure what that is in dollars, but you know, hugely expensive. But at the end of the 50s and in the 60s, these were places that were kind of owned by slum landlords, where, you know, a row of about nine houses might have up to about 300 people living in them. So these are kind of huge transformations taking place.
Yeah. It kind of sounds familiar to me as well. When I was a student in New Zealand, in Auckland, was this neighborhood kind of close to the CBD or the center of the city, which my friends told me that used to be a working class area and that nobody really wanted to live in. But now it just couldn't afford to live in that because the houses were kind of posh and expensive. You couldn't even rent an apartment there because it was simply out of the budget for a lot of people. I guess examples like this are can easily be found in most places in the world.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting that the term gentrification was coined in London in 1964, the same year that Conrad's Habitat opened. But at that moment, it was also about kind of class confusion, about how you couldn't really, these places are absolutely bourgeois, absolutely kind of upper middle class and kind of exclusionary. But in the 60s, in the kind of time I'm looking at, they're really very much kind of happening side by side. You know, the same street might have social housing in, people who are kind of flipping these houses and turning them into places where clearly wine is being drunk and dinner parties are being had, and then further on down the road there's a kind of a multiple occupancy house and maybe even a squat or two. So this is a moment where those kind of class divides are still being kind of fought over and haven't been absolutely kind of solidified.
Let's talk about sociology here, and I'm a huge fan of Stuart Hall, and I was really amazed to see him in your book. So, but first, let's talk about the role of sociology, let's say, in making people conscious of the idea of class in the 1960s and 70s. What was that role, and was there ever this feeling in England back then that we were moving towards a classless society? And what was the role of popular sociology in making these ideas more prominent?
Yeah. Yes, I mean, it's a very good question. I mean, there's really how we think about that might actually take us back to Hume as well, because it's also about how things feel to us rather than how they might be within a kind of analytic world. And this is, I think, interesting where to think about Stuart Hall, where he actually very much kind of addresses how class feels rather than how class is structured. Now, to think about this in the kind of the broader picture, sociology wasn't really a kind of big important subject in Britain. I mean, Britain really didn't have that kind of tradition of sociology that you would see in a country like France or Germany. You know, there was no Durkheim or Weber or, you know, these kind of big names. But by the 50s and into the 60s, you know, sociology is kind of really taking off, and it's taking off partly because higher education is really, really expanding, and sociology is seen as a kind of very kind of modern discipline that people might kind of get interested in as you know, Britain kind of modernizes in the wake of the Second World War. But it also kind of has this kind of very much kind of popular status. So new magazines like New Society kind of emerge, which has as its kind of main kind of remit to kind of popularize sociology, to make sociology available to as many people as possible. Penguin are bringing out their Pelican kind of very cheap kind of sociological books that are just really aimed at the, you know, people who are just kind of interested in the modern world. And they're trying to talk to a non-academic kind of readership. You know, this would be a kind of, you know, people generally interested in what's kind of happening in the world. But there's also the role of the sociologist becomes, weirdly enough, a kind of figure within popular literature and in within kind of popular kind of films and TV programs. Famously, Malcolm Bradbury's The History Man has this character of a kind of Marxist sociologist, very much at the heart of what was meant to be a kind of comedic book. So the sociologist is there as a figure of comedy, but also a figure kind of telling us about the world. Now, in relation to class, I think there's some interesting things going on here, because the sociologists aren't saying, okay, this is what's happening in terms of class, and we're offering this to you so that you can be conscious of it. That wasn't really what was going on. They were saying, oh my God, hasn't things kind of changed? Aren't things kind of really complicated? People don't know what kind of class they're in. So there's kind of big project, and you can see it through a magazine like New Society, where they're saying, how do we understand what's happening? Really, we're in a situation where those old kind of categories, either your middle class or your working class, no longer simply fit. Now, of course, people have been thinking that for a while, and they'd be coming up with all sorts of terms like lower middle class, upper lower class, upper working class, all these terms to really show how actually kind of gradualist the whole thing was. But what you get in kind of popular sociology are people saying, maybe we need new ideas of class. So you're getting this idea of, well, maybe we should talk about the homeowner class. Maybe we should talk about the technician class and the administrative class. And these are kind of really, really, you know, talked about a lot in kind of popular literature. They've now completely disappeared. So it was interesting for me to kind of re-find all these discussions about the administrative class and the technical class and things like that. But I guess one of the terms that did stick was this idea of the new middle class. And this is one of the things that kind of really, really kind of preoccupies sociologists. So there are kind of big projects that go on. So for instance, there's one project in Luton car manufacturing industry. So they're looking at kind of factory workers in the car industry who are actually earning, you know, quite good money. People are complaining that they're earning much better money than teachers were, for instance. That is, those professions that have been seen as being kind of absolutely kind of middle class. And they were enjoying those things that previously had been thought of as very middle class. Holidays abroad, owning your own home, owning your own car, all these kinds of things. So what do you do when you've got a situation where the working class, the traditional working class, had been, were now enjoying the fruits, partly through the labor movement, through the kind of union movement, you know, they're getting kind of good money. So they're enjoying the fruits that had normally been only associated with being a professional, being part of the kind of professional class. So there was a big worry. And one of the worries was political. Why would anyone vote for the Labour Party? Why would anyone vote for a party so associated with the working class as the Labour Party, with the unions, when really they were performing their lives, their everyday lives, in very similar ways to middle class people? So the sociologists all kind of went into these kind of car manufacturers and interviewed people and found out, really what they found out was pretty, still pretty confused. It was that they quite often had very much, very strong political allegiances, very much thought of, especially the men, thought of themselves as distinctly working class. That was their tradition. They would vote Labour. That was them kind of through and through. And the Conservative Party, the party for the middle classes, was seen as snobs, as really kind of anti the working man. And the man was obviously a crucial thing at that point. Now, the women in these households were often thinking themselves quite differently, because they were kind of recognizing that actually they were living quite a kind of middle class lifestyle, and that the men were too. as far as their hobbies went, as far as their weekends went. So these kind of this idea of kind of class was very much kind of in the air. Now, what made Stuart Hall kind of really interesting in this is that he's a kind of figure of what was called the New Left. He's kind of emerging as one of the kind of main kind of movers and shakers here. He's an editor of the Universities and Left magazine, which then becomes part of this thing called the New Left Review. And he writes this essay called A Sense of Classlessness. And it's really important that we're really attentive to his words here. He's not saying that classlessness was coming about. He's saying there's a sense of classlessness. So people feel that the old categories of class no longer apply. They don't want to be bothered with all these kind of finickety ways of thinking about the technical class or the administrative class. They just want to think, okay, well, we're just not part of the kind of traditional what their parents' generation or their grandparents' generation thought of as either working class or middle class. So Hall was kind of really interested in that, and basically his argument was that this is how people feel. They feel disconnected from kind of old ideas of socialism, of kind of unions, and older ideas of working class. Now, for him, that didn't mean the class had gone away. Not at all. It had just been obscured. It had been kind of confused, and it had been confused by consumerism, by us entering into kind of a commodity culture where everything was about kind of your own kind of private experience of commodity culture of consumerism, rather than a kind of collective, a kind of older kind of collective culture of class identity. And he was kind of really interested. Well, what does that mean for something like socialism? What does it mean for a kind of left populism? How can you attract people who feel this way? And really, you can see that kind of the long arm of this kind of moving into something like kind of New Labour at the end of the 90s and kind of attracting people who are homeowners who have these kind of values about kind of individualism. Now, I think what's interesting is that at the time when he published this in 1964, absolutely loads and loads of people on the New Left, people like E.P. Thompson, were up in arms. You know, you can't say this. You can't even talk about this. But now we look back on it and say, well, actually, you know, class was getting really confused. Things were really changing. And Stuart Hall absolutely kind of nailed that sense of confusion, that sense of difference between how people feel about things and how things were actually kind of changing. So the contradiction for me is that you can see more and more people feeling that they're in kind of enjoying a kind of middle class lifestyle or something like a middle class lifestyle. Elements, you know, people sending their kids to university more and more. People enjoying things like holidays abroad. So you've got that kind of big expansion of people feeling that they're entering into the new middle classes. But actually, structurally, and this is probably true globally, what you're getting at the same time is more and more ownership falling into fewer and fewer hands. You know, so in a sense, you know, what's actually happened is that we've all become more and more kind of proletarianized. You know, I'm a professor at a university. I earn good money, but I have, you know, in lots of ways, my job is I'm told what to do. I'm having to fill out audit forms the whole time about what I do and how I do things. you know, I don't have the autonomy that a university professor would have had 20 years ago, 50 years ago, 70 years ago. And you can see that being played out across the board. You know, doctors or people working in industry, you know, we're all being thought of in terms of kind of appraised, how we're appraised, how we kind of relate to human resources. We're cogs in a machine that are owned and controlled by an elite that we never see. So in that sense, that is the contradiction, isn't it? We feel, oh, we're doing quite well, but actually, you know, our control over our lives, our power in terms of kind of class power has altered as well, and often, you know, downwardly.
I just do like to mention something about my own country, about when you were talking about the feeling or the feel of class mobility. So, well, obviously the economy is not really doing well in my country because of the sanctions and a whole suite of other reasons, but people who are sort of middle class, or if you can use that term, even in Iran, they were, first of all, there was this mushroom growth of luxury restaurants and cafes, quite similar, or even in some cases, more luxurious than the ones you find in Europe. And it's becoming more and more trendy to go to these restaurants in Iran, although the economy is not, and people are kind of poor. And another trend that became more common in the past 15 years was international travel. But of course, with an Iranian passport, you can't get to go far. But a lot of people are going to countries like Turkey or Malaysia. And they're still kind of lower middle class. But I guess these, and they use it in social media. They use pictures of when they go to a restaurant, they just post pictures. And there was a very good article that an Iranian academic wrote about it. And he talked about the idea of temporary class mobility. And I was very much reminded of that article when I was reading your book and the reference to Stuart Hall's essay about the feel of class mobility.
I think that phrase, temporary class mobility, is a really great one. I mean, I think it's not necessarily a kind of new thing, I don't think. I mean, one of the things that made me think more complicatedly about Lars was a project I've been involved with at my university, which is this project called Mass Observation. And it was set up in the 30s, at the end of the 30s. And it was an idea, I guess, of kind of popular sociology, popular anthropology, but being done by people from the ground up. So people would kind of observe other people, but people would also kind of write diaries. And it was going to be the observation of everyone by everyone, and everyone would have their kind of own expertise. So this was, you know, years and years before social media. But one of the projects they look at is pub culture in the 1930s. And what they're doing is they're kind of looking at how in kind of industrial northern cities, all the workers from the mills, you know, are wearing cloth caps, and they're going into the pubs after work, and they're sitting in the public bar where beer is cheaper, where there's no carpet, where they're allowed to swear, where they can spit on the floor. I mean, they've been, you know, working kind of very, very dusty environments. But at the weekend, they would go into the saloon bar, and they wouldn't be wearing their cloth caps. They'd be wearing, you know, their nice suits. They'd be wearing bowler hats. And for all intents and purposes, looking like they were part of the middle class. And so there's this kind of idea, and this is why the idea of kind of consciousness and feeling is so important. You know, absolutely proletariat during the week, absolutely kind of working class. But at the weekend, you know, you want to enjoy. And so the people kind of observing this was just saying, people go upper class at the weekend. You know, that's what happens. And that is when you're thinking about things from the point of view of experience, rather than thinking about kind of analytic kind of categories. So I think, yeah, temporary class ability is a really, really useful way of bringing that together.
One question that I have is about race and class. How was the idea of race and class interrelated? Was it possible for migrants who moved to Britain at that time to have the same, to enjoy the same kind of taste or lifestyle as their white counterparts?
So this is an interesting and kind of complicated area, because a number of things are happening at the same time. In the late 40s onwards, you're having more and more kind of Commonwealth migration from kind of British kind of colonial countries. So lots of people are coming over from Jamaica, Barbados, the West Indies, but also people moving from what will become Bangladesh, East Pakistan, and India, and Pakistan, coming to Britain for work. And they're being invited, and many of them had fought in the Second World War and had been stationed in Britain, so they were kind of continuing that experience. Now, one of the things that has to be kind of reckoned with is the sort of massive class disappointment, I think, that happened to lots of people. There was an assumption, I think, that actually, if you had a kind of middle class job or kind of working arrangement, you know, you worked in an office in Kingston, Jamaica, then you might be able to do the same thing in Kingston upon Thames in London. That wasn't going to happen. You know, this issue is a structural racism here, that simply wasn't going to be the case. So that lots of immigrants, West Indian immigrants, are given the kind of lowest jobs, street cleaners, working on the buses, working on the trains, working at the post office. These are the jobs that they're getting. Now, it's not the same case with Indian migrants in the subcontinent, who are often thinking about things quite kind of differently and actually kind of setting up their own businesses, their own kind of networks, with a kind of slightly different kind of arrangement. So for instance, going into kind of the restaurant trade, or going into carpet trade, or things like that. So these were their kind of own businesses, not usually earning any more money than if you were working as a street cleaner. These were often kind of businesses that kind of valued autonomy, but actually didn't make very much money, where people kind of worked kind of endless kind of hours. The Indian corner shop in Britain is kind of an example of that. So what you're getting is that the migration involves class mobility, but it's a downwards mobility. But at the same time, lots of those people in migrant communities are buying their own houses. And they're doing this partly because, again, a structural racism. It's almost impossible to rent, or if you do rent, you feel kind of exploited because of your race. Lots of landlords will be taking advantage of you and giving you kind of higher rents. Very difficult to get into kind of social housing. So buying your own house and filling it with a kind of multi-generational family was absolutely, again, a kind of way of hanging on to your own autonomy. And of course, also people who are migrating are bringing culture with them. One of the interesting things about migrants from the Caribbean is that they're often bringing a very strong sense of British culture, but a strong sense of British culture that no longer exists in Britain. So an idea of the parlour as a very kind of a room of care and politeness, So they weren't embracing that kind of habitat lifestyle world, even though Habitat was also selling lots of kind of Indian textiles and, you know, had this kind of idea of kind of cosmopolitanism. So what happens is it takes a while for migrant communities to produce a middle class, you know, that actually you're not getting a kind of black and brown middle class, a kind of black and brown new middle class emerging at the same time as the new middle class of kind of white culture. So there's kind of delays in this, and they're absolutely to do with structural racism in the culture.
Professor Benheimer, thank you very, very much for your time, for speaking with us on New Books Network.
Thank you very much for having me.